This is Xformation, brought to you by the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. I'm Will, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Caden, as always. Hey-o. But we also have a special guest today, Elise Dick of the Information Technology and Information Innovation Foundation, ITIF. I always say ITIF. I'm sorry. I always do that.
Right? It's so a mouthful.
Actually, I always, like when I'm reading this on the screen, I actually have to think. So I'm like, ooh.
I wrote it down for that one purpose, Will. I wrote it all out.
I'm horrible. But yeah, Elise,
how's it going?
Yeah, how is it going today?
Me? That's me.
Yes, yeah. Elise, yes, you. Yes, of course.
I am going good. I am returning to office life, remembering the shirts that I own, which is really exciting. Turns out I have some really great stuff that's not like sweatpants.
Oh, yeah.
So that's been the joys of my week.
I've been waiting to wear a few suits now. Like I have suits hanging up that are just perfect, and I haven't been able to wear them in front of anyone but Kenzie. And it's getting a little old, you know, I kind of want to show off.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about some of the stuff that Elise has been working on. And I know this is also something that Caden is interested in. A lot of AR, VR innovation policy, this idea of augmented reality, virtual reality. There's a lot of articles you see here. At least three articles have been published.
Yeah. All on June 1st. Uses.
Yeah. And so we'll put those in the show notes as well. But, you know, you're the expert in AR, VR. I don't know if you want to start this off, Caden.
I have one big question. I just want to know how long each of us have used VR. For me, it's like a year, maybe 2 years, Elise.
Yeah, solidly for a year, but I've been a video game nerd for much longer. So I've certainly experienced it well before I started doing this.
And then Will?
I mean, I've gone over to other friends' houses. I know. No, they're literally in the show notes. It literally says womp, womp, womp.
I've been waiting for that so long.
Yeah. No, I mean, so yeah, I go over to friends' places and, you know, hey, maybe they've got, you know, maybe they have an Oculus. I've experienced it a bit, but I'm also not a gamer, right? So
we talked about this with Epic Games, right? That my gaming experience is almost exclusively VR now. And Will's is just sort of like watching his friends do the gaming, which is fun.
It's true. Yeah, I'll stream it. You know, I'll put it on the background and put it in, you know, and stream when people are doing this. But, yeah, so before we even get into this, what is the distinction between VR and AR? I would love to like a little.
And what is XR too? That's another thing that pops up a lot.
So XR is the umbrella term. I don't always use it because sometimes it feels too broad to me. I usually just say AR, VR. AR is the best example that most people know is like Pokemon Go. It's where you take a view of the physical reality and you overlay digital objects onto it. The futuristic view of it is like Iron Man visor views or... that kind of thing.
Yes.
VR is where you have a fully immersive experience. So you have a headset, it's blocking out the world around you, and you are in 360-degree 3D virtual space. So, you know, your Facebook Oculus, your PSVR, those things are all VR. Ready Player One would be the fun sci-fi example for that. If you've seen that, that's all a VR experience.
Seen it or read it?
Well, or both.
Or both.
It depends. You can't see me, obviously.
Yeah. No. I was a nerd way back in the day, so I do remember reading. I remember reading this when I was like 12. I'm like, oh, that's a cool idea. But realizing very, very quickly that it would have taken them forever, which apparently it did. The idea has been on the back burner since like the 80s, if I recall correctly, or the 90s. But it took so long to actually get clearance. Disney had to merge and buy everything.
VR has been around for so long. I mean, the first fully immersive experience was in the 60s with like flight simulations. So the idea is not new. Most people have probably tried an Oculus for the first time in the last 5 years, but... we've been trying to make this thing happen for a really long time.
So wait a second. So flight simulations would be considered VR? I would just always think of that as almost like a game. But
Have you guys tried the flight simulator at the Air and Space Museum? Pre-pandemic, they have this flight simulator that's, it'll like pick you up and do, you know, barrel rolls and all that. And you're flying this jet. And it's got like a machine that makes it simulate the actual environment. And you actually feel like you're flying a jet. It's way fun. I definitely recommend. And if I sound kind of funky, everyone, it's because I'm in a little cubicle thing at a WeWork. People are walking all around me. Will got the big.
They're going to learn. It's going to be great. Ugh.
But back to VR, I've got this ongoing debate with Will that it's not just gaming, right? That there are use cases for it, and that specifically it could be considered exercise, at least when I do it, because I'm playing ping pong and table tennis.
That's the debate. That's the debate. To be very, very clear, yeah. I don't think it's exercise.
I mean, my heart rate goes up. I play it for like an hour and a half. I get really sweaty, and I've noticed that I'm a little bit more in shape in general, right? Like my heart rate in general has fallen. I've gotten a little bit better at climbing stairs. I think it's good for you. What do you think, Elise? You're the expert.
So, yeah, it's different from playing like a video game, you know, on a TV. You're actually moving. You have to complete the motion that you want to do in the virtual space.
Yeah.
So it depends on what you're doing, right? If you're in a social experience and you're just sort of walking around, maybe not. Mm-hmm. But there are VR workout apps. I use one. I do VR workouts a couple of times a week where you're actually working up a sweat, and it's made for that. And it tracks your fitness just like any other workout experience. We use Ring Fit in this house also, and I find that I get a very similar workout in VR as well.
Wait, what?
So
is
it
Ring
can't
Fit?
Be exercise, is what I'm gonna give you, Will. It can be, exercise. But I will allow that it is not be. Always exercise.
Okay. Yes. It probably can be.
It's really hard to eat potato chips when you're playing VR, Will. I think that's probably the best example, right? Like you think about gamers eating potato chips.
When you're biking, it's really, really easy to eat potato chips. So when you're doing a super long, because
you're an experienced biker. So, and by biker, I mean bicyclist. You're an experienced biker.
Yes. No, I do. Yeah, I do. I do like long form, I guess. Long form bicycling. I don't know. I don't know what the term is. I don't know.
Marathon?
I mean, I still bike everywhere. I bike everywhere in this city if possible.
Yeah. And he's got a cool little bike too from like the 70s that he's restored.
I think it's from the 60s. I actually really don't know. This bike is just it's a Franken bike. It literally, like, I've been talking to a whole bunch of my friends who are actually really, really very sharp bikers, and they really have never seen anything like it before because none of the parts match, which is great.
Well, right? Let me segue
this
that.
It's probably really dangerous.
Let me segue that then, because with AR, there's this possibility of having like a GPS pop-up display. So like you're a glasses wearer, so you have your glasses on and you're not really sure how to get where you're going, but you have like, you know, little directional displays in your glasses while you're riding your bike. You don't have to look down at your phone, etc. That's sort of the big innovation of AR, I think. Is that right, Elise?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the future that these glasses developers are envisioning, right? We want to be able to take what we can already do on our smartphone screen and put it in front of your face. Obviously, there are going to be some limitations on how much of your space you can cover when you're driving and walking. But the idea is, you could bring up your maps and, you know, how you have Google Maps right now, and it'll put the path in front of you on your phone.
Yeah.
You could do that in glasses and it would show you where you're going, or it would bring up a weather report, a radar if you're outside and you want to know if it's about to storm on you. You know, little things like that. That would doesn't have as much friction, I guess, as using your phone for the same information.
Well, there was, at least in the early 2010s, maybe earlier, something called Google Glass. Do you remember Google Glass? Will, do you remember
Google
this?
Glass does exist still for enterprise, but it is no longer a consumer product.
See, I was really excited about it.
What's the application for enterprise?
So AR right now is mostly used in enterprise. It's not totally futuristic. There are AR goggles and glasses and headsets that you can get. It's really helpful for like see what I see sort of trainings. So you can overlay information on physical space. You can use it, for example, if you're an engineer, you could use it to view instructions in real time as you're working through a really complex building process. You know, so there's huge applications for enterprise, and actually a lot of advanced manufacturers are using AR right now. Not so much on the consumer side, because Google Glass was not really the most attractive item. And so far we haven't quite figured
out what I'm getting at. You know, was it the biometric tracking? Was it the video cameras in theaters? What was it?
So Google Glass is a really interesting case because, I mean, I think it was just 10 years too early, because I think people would be more on board, and people are more on board with something like that now. There were a couple issues. The first one was just, it was really expensive. It was like $1,500 to get this thing on your face that like wasn't widespread, kind of made you look weird. There was a, you know, glass holes was the stigma. for people who are walking around with this camera on their face.
Yeah. It just looked weird. I mean, to somebody who's worn glasses his entire life, you know, that to me is the most like odd thing. It's just like, wait a second. So they're like, and it didn't, and even for glasses wearers, it did not work at all. So for me, like you couldn't really attach it to anything. It just didn't work. And it's like, well, wait a second. I'm the use case. I'm like, why shouldn't you have something that actually adapts onto, you know, my normal pair of glasses or something that's, you know, adaptable to my pair of glasses. And that's also what I didn't understand about it at all.
And I think on the social side, you know, the whole glass holes issue, that was really more of a bystander privacy issue. I think that there were significantly fewer concerns on the wearer side. I don't think people were really worried about the information they were giving to Google necessarily.
Yeah.
But people who saw someone walking toward them with a camera on their face were very uncomfortable and didn't know what information that person was providing to Google or just recording for themselves. So, you know, it highlighted that we as a society were not ready for that technology yet. Maybe now that we have more smartphones and more cameras and more recording devices out in the world, that's changed. But I don't think Google Glass was ready.
Yeah, let's go. But I'd like to go more into that. There is this concern of privacy and especially with these, you know, with these products. There's also a very clear issue of equity as well. And I'm wondering if you could kind of delineate that. I know you've been writing a lot about that and thinking a lot about that in particular.
Yeah. So privacy, I look at in two separate, but I guess overlapping ways. First of all, you have the bystander privacy issue. So that's, you know, what information, if I'm using a wearable device, or even if I have AR on my phone, or if I have VR goggles that are collecting information about the space around me that might not be my own private home. You know, what does that mean for the people around me who aren't necessarily able to consent to that data collection? And then the second aspect of privacy is the user privacy. Because these devices, in order to function, need to collect a lot of potentially sensitive biometric information about you. It's not like you can just turn off, you know, don't collect information about my movement, because then you can't move in VR. It's really valuable information for the product, but that is information that, you know, could be really sensitive, could reveal things about you to employers or to strangers. And so making sure that users have control over that data is also really important. And obviously, when we start talking about the equity issue, especially vulnerable groups who might be using these technologies or surrounded by these technologies, then that privacy issue comes into play again. So it's a hairy situation that I don't think there's a good answer yet, as, you know, these aren't widespread enough that we have really had a chance to think about it.
What are the vulnerable groups that you imagine being implicated in this, or at least butting up against this?
There's a lot. I think generally speaking, any groups that are already vulnerable to harm or discrimination from technology are also vulnerable with these technologies. Mm-hmm. You know, groups that might be adversely affected by surveillance technology. If we have law enforcement using AR glasses, what does that mean? We have, you know, women and people of color and LGBT communities who might face harassment in virtual spaces. There are plenty of studies showing that, you know, there is a concern about this, and women actually don't necessarily feel safe in VR because they see these same things translated into virtual space. And then, of course, you have the question of equity and access. You know, can people with disabilities actually use these devices, or do they have viable alternatives? Do people without a strong broadband connection have a way to access these virtual spaces, especially if, you know, we're looking at beyond video games and we're using them for things like healthcare or government services or employment? You know, thinking about how this is going to affect different groups of people with different means of access is a really important thing to start doing now, so that it can move beyond gaming.
Well, I want to kind of expand on that then, because there have been a few articles come out that say current VR headsets are designed for male faces instead of female faces, meaning whenever I put on a headset, I don't feel motion sickness at all, right? So there is no problem for me. But one of the reasons, among many, that there aren't as many women on VR right now is that whenever they put on headsets, the thing is just not designed right, and it just gets all funky. They get all nauseous, and it feels terrible. And there have been a couple essays on this, one from Dana Boyd, another one from a group at Frontiers. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. I mean, is this real? Is it conjecture?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely discussion and at least anecdotal evidence that this is a thing. And I think it makes sense that if you're designing for one type of face or one type of body structure, this could happen. There's also an issue with people who have head coverings, or there was one researcher who was using VR headsets in Africa, and people with braids or large hair actually broke the straps because they couldn't wear the device. So really at the basic design level, thinking about making sure people can actually put on the headset and use it, you've got to do that before they can even start talking about, you know, safety and privacy and all these other things. And I think there's been more recognition as more and more people are starting to use these devices, you know, that you can adjust your viewfinder now. Mm-hmm. You can adjust your straps. You can buy things to balance out the weight. And hopefully as we have more people adopting the technology, we can recognize the different ways that we can make it as available to as many people as possible.
Yeah, I do remember that. I mean, again, I haven't used this as much as other people have, but I know that the weight was actually a really, really big thing that I was like, even someone over to a friend's house a couple, I guess it was almost 2 years ago now, when the second version of Oculus came out. And one of the things I noticed about it was even playing, I forget the name, like the little bow and arrow game, like doing that only for like 30 or 40 minutes afterwards, that like it just actually just physically hurt as a...
Yeah, it fits on your head. Like, it just... clamps on, right?
Right. And this is exactly the same thing that I've been facing with masks. Like I've just hated the masks, and you know, not like I'm anti-mask or anything along those lines, but I've hated it because it just, none of it really feels comfortable. It's not something like, you know, constantly tugging at your ears. Again, I have glasses, and that's kind of an understandable thing that I've been dealing with for quite some time, but just the comfort that you can imagine with these products is I think a really, really big element for it. Which, yeah, I didn't even really know about this until...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was telling you about this a couple podcasts ago, how I woke up on my 27th birthday and realized I tweaked my neck. And it was because I have the original Oculus Quest, and it's heavy, man. And I put it on, and I was just going crazy playing ping pong. And so once I tweaked my back, I was like, you know, I'll take it easy for a week or two. And I did. And then I put this thing on, and within 15 minutes, I was right back to where I was on my 27th birthday. Just totally in pain. Definitely hurt myself.
This is not evidence that it's exercise.
No, it's not.
None of this is evidence that it's exercise, by the way.
Evidence that the thing is just super heavy, right? It's super heavy on your head. I have a bunch of comfort aids, like pads and things that go onto mine to balance the weight. But it's still a lot of weight to put on your head and on your neck. So people with weaker necks than mine, which is saying something, might have an issue there. But I sort of want to pivot this conversation because I've been really interested in developments in VR wearables, right? Like training firefighters, for example, there are these wearables that they put on that simulate actual emergency situations. And they put on this headset and they can do trainings and feel the fire and feel pressure on them as they do whatever firefighters do. Good stuff. Have you looked into this, Elise? Is this something that's coming out of left field?
Yeah, no, a major area of using VR for law enforcement training, for public safety training. I know that NIST actually does a lot of work on public safety training and communications using AR and VR technologies. It's a huge use case, especially for the government. And it's one of the easier entry points, I think. You know, we're not asking you to have meetings on the moon in VR or something. We're just saying put on this much lower risk simulation. Mm-hmm. It's also used a lot for, like I said, law enforcement, especially for training with implicit bias. So helping law enforcement officers go through simulations and actually see, you know, did they react differently? Did they have different physiological responses to certain situations based on race, gender, setting, and that kind of stuff? So it's a really great tool for training, especially because A, it's low cost. If you have to travel, usually for a simulation, it's much easier. And B, because it's also lower risk. So, you know, you can slowly introduce people to situations without throwing them into perhaps something that's going to be physically or emotionally dangerous for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. Practicing is often better than being taught something, right? The best example I have, which is not related to this at all, but it's this VR ad that I keep getting. This game wants me to buy because it's meant to help you hit a ball in baseball better. Like you just do reps over and over again until you can hit the ball. And for me specifically, I am not a baseball person now because I couldn't hit the ball. I just couldn't hit it. And I sucked. It was awful. And this game is just dedicated to practice. And for firefighter training, for police training, that's got to be an element to it. You know, you practice the situation, you do it once and you see that you made a mistake, you can go back and try it again instead of having to, you know, deal with the consequences that come from your actions.
Yeah. And there's a lot of research showing that, you know, when we're in VR, we actually do embody the experience. Our brains know that we're not really there, but part of it thinks we are. So it actually is like doing it physically. It's not like clicking through some buttons on a computer or watching a video. It really gets you that same, you know, cognitive entrenchment of your training or the lesson that you're learning in a way that 2D media really can't. So it's really valuable for any kind of learning or training situation because it's like you actually did it in person. And sometimes it can be even better because you can, like you said, repeat it different times or do it faster or slower or get more feedback than you necessarily would if you were doing it in physical space.
So now I'm going to pivot again, and I hope everyone's keeping up a whiplash like I have. So I used VR primarily during the pandemic for workspaces. Whenever I was studying for the bar or finishing law school or working with Will and I was just not in the zone, I would put on my headset. I would do this thing where it remotes into my desktop. And all of a sudden, my computer was a movie screen and I could work that way. It was like tunnel vision. Have you tried the experimental feature where you can set up a little virtual desk in front of you and like draw out your couch and you sit down on what is really your couch, but it's virtual? Have you tried that?
Oh, yeah, I have that. The one thing I wish is that I could do different scenarios, though, because now I use my Oculus at my office and at home.
Oh, yeah.
So I would love to have like work desk mode and then it's
right, like the Guardian setup.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
It just knows which room you're in. No, and you're actually, I think, one of the first people to have a VR networking event, right?
Yeah, I did have a VR networking event.
Tell me about
event.
This panel because I missed it, unfortunately.
They are really a thing. There's a lot, especially in alt space, people use that a lot for VR networking events. Especially if, you know, you're already talking to VR people, they all have a headset. Yeah. I went to another conference that had, it replicated a college campus and had a big networking event there in VR. It's a huge opportunity for sort of that gathering and collaboration aspect. I actually, my boss and I both work remotely. We have our Monday check-ins in VR where we sit down and put our to-do list for the week on a big screen we sit next to each other and we can take open documents and look at them in front of us and hand them to each other and that kind of thing.
That's so cool.
Okay,
I've never actually worked with
someone. You guys are, I think you guys are convincing me that I should.
Yes,
I think so. Because then you guys could do the podcast in VR.
Oh,
just
wow.
For funsies.
That could be fun, Will.
I don't know about that.
All right, so I'm going to pivot one more time because I want to talk about the makers of headsets.
This battle for domination. This is actually what I'm really, really interested in, which is where does this all shake out, right? I mean, because we've talked a lot about the interesting, and not to add too much of my own viewpoint on this, but I'm still, you know, a lot of this technology, it seems interesting, but at the same time, it's like, well, what's like the killer app, right? What's the thing that everyone would want to flock towards? And, you know, when I think of even PlayStation technologies, when I think about a lot of those sorts of gaming systems, I think it's pretty clear, right? Games themselves can be hugely immersive systems. They have great storylines. There's a whole bunch of really, really cool things you can do. And, you know, part of that's there clearly because of quality of television, because of ease of use. There's a whole bunch of range of things that gaming systems have really benefited from over the years, in addition to a whole bunch of other kind of like hardware and technical requirements. So who are the major players here? Where do they see this happening? Because I mean, as I see it, it's still most of the, I know PlayStation is getting into this space, but from my understanding, it's still kind of not as connected to, say, gaming as you would think. And it's still, so it's not, it feels almost like an orphan, right? It's not really in the gaming community all that much. And maybe I'm wrong. I could be completely wrong at this. But it also doesn't seem like a massive consumer product in the way that you'd have a phone, in the way that the iPhone completely revolutionized everything, right?
You're starting to sound like a VR denier now, like someone who's saying VR is just a fad. That is actually
a
thing.
No,
it is
no,
a thing,
I'm,
right?
No,
there hasn't
no,
been enough
know,
acceptance I, yet is kind yeah. of the argument. What do you think, Elise? You're the person.
Yeah. I mean, I would say I think you're right that it's not a big portion of the gaming world, but most consumers' entry point into VR is games. Now, most consumers' entry point into AR is those fun little Instagram filters that you can do. But there, so, and I think that, you know, when we're talking about this, we shouldn't ignore AR because it has huge potential, especially as a consumer product, but also for a lot of different use cases. I think VR, you know, I don't necessarily think everyone in the world is going to have a headset, but I do think that they're going to become more useful as the technology improves, as they become more comfortable to wear. This new aspect of having them wireless, I think, is really important. And obviously, when we're talking about the players, you know, we have everything from the Oculus, which is a couple hundred bucks, all the way up to these super high-end enterprise headsets that can go well into the thousands, like the but have fun index. Things like mouth tracking and eye tracking and really like frame rates and quality, and they're awesome. I don't need one to hang out in Supernatural, do my workouts, and meet my boss in VR. But so right now, the range on the market, you know, lends it to these sort of two buckets of the gaming enthusiasts and then the really high-end enterprise. And I think as the technology sort of converges to somewhere in the middle, we're going to see a lot more use cases for your standard office workplace. And I would love to see more government use for government services. And I would love to see more healthcare use as well, as more people have access.
So moving into then sort of the sustainability of VR as not just like something where you have to buy the next gaming console like PlayStation and Xbox have been, but moving into something that makes the headset sort of standalone where the games aren't just a one-time purchase, but they continue to acquire revenue. Facebook has recently announced that they'll be experimenting with ads. And I told you I was going to ask about
surprise.
because I don't know very much about it. And I'd love for you to just kind of give us the rundown.
Yeah, I think the Facebook ad thing is very interesting. Because I think in the VR community, people knew that ads were coming eventually to Oculus. It's Facebook. They're an ad revenue based company. It just makes sense on their business model that they're going to put ads into VR. But the way that they did it was that they had one partner come on, and it's an arena-based game. So basically the idea was when you're playing in an arena, like a sports arena, there's going to be an ad based on, you know, your Facebook user data and your in-game data, but not your biometric information or any recordings.
Right.
People did not like that. People who play this game did not like that. But one of the main criticisms was people had already bought this game, and they said, you know, I paid for this game. Why am I now getting ads?
Yeah.
So there was like within 3 days, there was a big rethinking of what this means. And the game provider actually released a statement. They pulled the ad experiment from this particular game and then talked about, you know, maybe releasing ads in some of their free to play games, because obviously these developers need to monetize as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think this was really interesting because, you know, it came out with this announcement. There was a lot of pushback from the gaming community, but also from people who are concerned about, you know, policy issues and privacy. And it already, you know, worked out the first kink, I guess. You know, it didn't just happen. People said, we don't like this.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, we're going to rethink this.
They actually listened.
And look, there's ads are coming to VR.
Yeah.
Probably AR. Like, this is going to happen.
It's going to happen.
And there's going to be growing pains, right? Like, for a while, it's going to feel like you're on the internet in 2002, and there's some really bright, flashy ads that are going to give you a seizure.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's going to be something similar to that in VR, probably. And people are, but that's the great thing is there will be consumer response, and that's how we're going to work out the kinks. So,
well, the interesting
thing for me,
interesting thing for me was that part of the revenue that comes from these ads would be going to the developers themselves, not just Oculus. And I've always sort of admired that Oculus hasn't blocked something called SideQuest, which is where developers that aren't on the Oculus store can test their games and distribute them to consumers for testing. Sometimes they can set prices and monetize their games. And Oculus could have blocked that altogether, like some of these Play Store suits have been going on, have done to other game stores. But they didn't. They left it there. And they allowed developers to continue to do that. And then with this in-game advertising thing where they're sharing the revenue, it seems to me that Oculus is very pro-developer. And that makes sense because developers make the games that make their headsets good, right? I'm sort of on the fence about it, though, because on the one hand, Facebook said, no, you don't have to have a Facebook account to play Oculus. And then they switched over and they were like, hey, you got to have a Facebook account. We can't do this, right? So that was kind of a It was it didn't pass the smell test. But then they've also got this pro developer side, which is not a big corporation move, I think.
I mean, I think you're right. One of the big issues right now in both VR and AR is there's just a really a lack of content. And it's sort of a chicken and egg problem, right? Like, not a lot of people have headsets, so not a lot of people are developing content for them, but there's not a lot of content, so people aren't getting headsets.
Right.
So finding ways to have developers.
It's a cold start problem. It's like classic within any network system, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is multi-sided markets, right? Well.
Oh, yeah. No, this is one area I do know very well about.
Yes. Yes. Well, Will, have we convinced you to buy a VR headset yet? Or an AR headset? If
maybe. I don't know. A lot of this, if we're going to be completely honest, a lot of it just comes down to money.
I mean, Eli is sitting right there next to you. He'll tell you 11 table tennis is the bomb. That's all you need to know. And it's relatively affordable to buy an Oculus Quest 2 right now. So.
Yeah,
what, and $300, I think.
Yeah, I really want to be able to pass you documents in VR, like Elise just described. I've never worked with someone in VR. I've just worked by myself. It's lonely, but it gets a lot of things done.
Working by yourself in,
don't say
in
that.
VR.
Don't say that.
I'm not convinced of this.
Well, Elise, thanks for joining us today. I am out of questions. I am so glad you came on because I've learned a ton.
Yeah, this has been very, very helpful. And like I said, we'll be putting all of your work in the show notes. And we, yeah, as always, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was fun.